The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 7, 2007. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. This morning I thought I would talk about the danger of delusion. Or perhaps the dangers of delusion, in a way that I have talked about before, but I thought maybe I should bring this up again. I thought I was pretty much done with this subject. Not the dangers of delusion so much, but specifically what I'm going to bring up today. Did anyone here see the journal with Bill Moyers last Friday? Yeah, at least a few people. I recommend checking that out once in a while. He's got some good stuff on there. The topic that he covered last Friday. I wasn't going to talk about this today, but afterward I just kind of had it on my mind. Pretty serious. Human delusion. The topic was about people who are millennialists. People who believe in the dispensation, that is, these different periods of time that the world is divided up into. From the innocence of Eden until the coming of the kingdom. These are people who have the ear of our president, George Bush, a sympathetic ear. These are also very active and well-organized people. And I don't want to criticize them, but what it is that they're caught up in, as most of us are, is delusion. But sometimes our delusions can be pretty serious and have implications for all of us. And if these thoughts are completely ill-founded, not based in reality, as very often they are not, in fact, I would say most often, I don't mean with these people, I mean with all of us, once again. We can really get into a lot of trouble. And these people are organized, they speak, they go and meet with political leaders, you know, senators and others, and the president. This particular group of people, they're really encouraging George Bush to attack Iran. To attack Iran, to bring on Armageddon, the final battle of good and evil, to exert a preemptive strike, and I think they even meant with nuclear weapons, thinking that somehow that this will bring on this final battle whereby Christ can come back and establish his kingdom here for the millennium. That's why they're called millennialists, because they will establish a kingdom here for 1,000 years. They really believe this. They don't seem to think, well, in fact, they don't think, because it's not in their doctrine to think, that by such a strike against these other people would bring they know we'd go to war and all that, but we would eventually be victorious and so we can establish this kingdom. It doesn't occur to them. And they want to do this preemptively because they're afraid that they're going to do this to us. Mm-hmm. So let's get them first. And of course, if they did that to us, what would we do? Well, we would strike back. If we do that to them, what would they do? They would strike back. But they think that by doing this, we can prevent the United States from ever getting hit. Well, of course, it's completely insane. And I mean that as the word is, insane. It is out of touch with reality. But there are many people, energized people, organized people who are working hard for this and have the ear of the president, the sympathetic ear of the president. Well, I talked a little bit about this sort of thing before. and how serious it was. And I think we all know this. But I think this time around, when they were talking about it, because I've been studying all of this stuff lately for a book I'm working on. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to tell you something about this millennialist thinking, this apocalyptic thinking. Where does this come from? Well, these people, in this very popular book among Christian fundamentalists, it's called the Book of Revelations, the Revelations of John, or the Apocalypse of John. It's the only piece of apocalyptic writing that got into the Bible, but there's all kinds of these writings. There's this whole genre of apocalyptic writing. Most people today are unaware of it because it's all in ancient texts that nobody is reading now except for scholars. But there are many of these writings. They're always attributed to some great person. It isn't like people writing today where you have the author recognizing this sort of thing and there's contracts and all sorts of things. No, if a piece of writing was there and you wanted people to read it or take it seriously, you put somebody's name on it. Like there's the Apocalypse of Abraham, which of course is ridiculous because Abraham, first of all, is fictional, but supposedly had lived a time centuries before. There's an Apocalypse of Adam that's been written. But many of these are apocalyptic pieces. But this one particular one, when they were putting together the New Testament, it ended up getting stuck in there. It wasn't enough just to have the Gospels and the Epistles, but then we had to have this apocalyptic text. And now there are people today who, I mean, this is like the scripture they go to. This is the one that they put all their money into, staking everything on it. And they believe it, and they think it's true, and they think it's about things to come in the end time. But let me tell you about this. Where did this kind of writing come from? How did it get started? Well, it appeared around the end of the 3rd century BCE, 2 centuries or a little more before the time of Christ. Prior to that, there wasn't any such writing like this. Why did that come about at that time? And what does it mean, and what's contained in this? Well, I was going to tell you this too, that all of these apocalyptic pieces have these 4 characteristics. First one is dualism. The world is divided up between good and bad, and you got to choose one side or the other. You're either with the forces of good or you're with the forces of evil. Okay, that's the first point. The second point is pessimism. This battle is coming. This end time is coming. There's nothing you can do about it. Don't worry about global warming or helping the poor or anything else. I mean, this is coming and there's nothing we can do to stop it. We might as well get on board, join either the forces of good or evil, and let's just have it out. Pessimism. The third characteristic of this is that it is a final battle to the end. The fourth one is that it is imminent, that it is coming soon. So these people believe this was something that was going to happen soon. Where did this kind of writing come from? How did this come about? Well, to really understand how we got to this point, because it wasn't in early Hebrew scriptures. You don't find any of this there. Early on, before the scriptures were written down, we had stories about these people who thought of themselves as God's chosen people. Why? Well, because they have a story about themselves, that they were kept in captivity in Egypt, and that they finally one day were able to escape this captivity. Many, many things associated with that, that go along with that. But there's no archaeological evidence of this. The archaeological evidence is that say the slaves who built the pyramids, this sort of thing, which is how we always envision this, they were actually had work people there, and they had villages where these people lived, and they appeared, from all the archaeological evidence, to be well cared for and didn't appear to be slaves. But nevertheless, you might have had a group of disgruntled people from that population that wanted to leave, and they had visions and stories of well, Abraham and these others, and that there was this land from the north that they had come from, but actually it was probably a collection of people from all over, because that's what it appears to be, the kind of people that were there working in these villages. But people were taking on this kind of a, at this point, a kind of a loose identity. And then they leave this area. Their stories later on said that they crossed the Red Sea, that God parted the Red Sea and they crossed. Well, stories can grow, you know. But more than likely, it was something like this, that north of the Red Sea, first of all, if you read the Bible and read the parting of the way, they got across in like 10 hours. You can't get across that fast if the seas had parted, and, you know, like Cecil B. DeMille and, you know, Charlton Heston and all that. And if that had happened, I mean, it wouldn't have worked. But there's a land north of the Dead Sea there, I mean the Red Sea, where there's just these shallow marshes. You probably wade into it up waist high or chest high, perhaps. But you could go through and you could walk there. It goes on for 10 or 20 miles before you get across. But you can get across there. And it could be that we have a band of people who are leaving. They're escaping. Finally, maybe the authorities back behind realize what's happening or whatever, and they decide they want to come and get these folk. Round them up. And so they see all the chariots, the war chariots coming, this sort of thing, and they're up against these marshes, and what do? Well, they just turn into the marsh, and they keep on walking, carrying their stuff. And when the war chariots come, they can't get into that. They can't, you know, so they eventually retreat and turn back. And it seems like a miracle, perhaps, to these people. So they get across, and they continue to travel. And they think about this. Well, along with these myths that they have, that they were inheriting, you know, the myths about Abraham, and Abraham had this vision that there was just one God. Everybody, all the lands around there, the Sumerians, everyone, for times way past, had believed in multiple gods of all kinds. There's a god of the hearth, and a god of the town, and a god of the clouds, and a god of the rain, and the god of the crops, and the god of just on and on and on. But this Abraham had this story, you know, that there was this one God. And that was their God. They were going to go back up to this place where the story was that God had given them this land. And so they were going to head back up that way. And of course, kind of vindication now that they escaped these authorities here that were chasing after them. You might get to thinking that, boy, you know, God's on our side here. That we are God's chosen people. So this kind of thinking can get into that. Of course, these are stories that were written down centuries later from when these events supposedly had taken place. But this is how the story goes, as it was finally written down. But who knows exactly what happened, or if anything at all really happened. But who knows? It's hard to say. Because it's lost in prehistory. But just looking at the archaeological evidence and other kinds of things, you can kind of piece together how stories were. Also stories of the bulrushes, and, you know, and the guy who would lead them out and all of this. There were all kinds of stories like this of babes found in bulrushes there back in Egypt in those days. Multitude of stories of all kinds. And a lot of them that ended up surrounding these people are not unique to these people, but can be found elsewhere. I've been researching this. It's just astounding. If you take the time to dig it out. Eventually, these people, they had this idea then that they were God's chosen people, that there was they had this kind of contract with God, that God would always protect them and take care of them, and that he had given them this land. Well, when they moved into that land, there were other people living there. And they managed to just slaughter a lot of them and wipe them out. And they got all kinds of writings saying why they should do that. I can give you the chapters and verses if you want to read some of these. So even God gave them this land, but it did belong to other people when they moved in. And they did all right for a while, but then they started running into trouble. Well, now we have the age of the prophets who's coming along. Now we're up to about the 8th or 9th century BCE. And they're starting to write down. We have these writers now, they're writing down these stories. And the myths of who these people were, where they came from, and all that, and that they were God's chosen people. But if they were God's chosen people, they had a real problem because history was not being kind to these people. They were constantly being battered and persecuted and all sorts of things. It didn't occur to them that maybe because the land they tried to settle in is right in the middle of these crossroads, they didn't have probably an overall picture of geography. In fact, very poor. They thought that the sky was kind of a bowl over their head, made of blue stone. So they didn't have a clear sense of the geography and all of that. And they were in a place where, you had the Syrians battling and the Babylonians and the Egyptians and later the Romans. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on in that area. And this poor little tribe was just constantly being battered around. If they were God's chosen people, how come they're being so mistreated? And then not only that, they got hauled off into Babylon finally after some time. And they were held captive in Babylon for about 45 years. And this would have been in about the 5th century BCE. And then finally, King Cyrus there, he finally let them go. He took over. And his policy was to let any captives that we have, let them go. Well, some of them didn't leave because it really wasn't that bad under Cyrus. Others thought about it. We were probably going to go, but others left right away. Go back to their city there in Jerusalem, where they had their temple and all of this. That had, they didn't know, but they always had these stories about how great their place was and all of this. It was God's gift to them and that sort of thing. And they went back. And, of course, they were profoundly disappointed because the place was in ruins. And once again, other people had moved in and were living there now. We were now in the age of prophets. And already by this time, even before they were hauled into Babylon, the prophets were beginning to explain to these people because they're starting to wonder, why are we so poorly treated when we're God's chosen people? So we enter now into a different age. First we had the age of the contract with God. Now we're entering into this prophetic age. With the prophets, then we're telling them, the reason we're being persecuted like this and we're having all this bad luck is because God is punishing us because we're not living according to God's laws. That's why we have all this misfortune. So we should start to practice God's laws. This is when they were hauled off to Babylon. Well, finally, they came back and they were there a couple more centuries go by and they're thinking about all of this, why we're still being persecuted. And even though many of them had become devout and practiced, and still they would fall on hardships and hard times, even hauled off to Babylon, that sort of thing, when they were practicing very hard to keep God's laws. Needed another explanation. Now we find the age of the apocalyptic writings, which started up in around the 3rd century BCE. And these apocalyptic writings, they tell these stories of this battle between good and evil. They didn't have any notion of this kind of stuff. There's nothing in their writings or in their history or stories or anything to indicate that they would have this kind of thinking at all until they were in Babylon. The religion of Babylon was Zoroastrianism. Zoroaster lived quite a few centuries before, maybe in 8th or 9th century, it's hard to say. Some put them even back to the 12th century. But sometime before that, Zoroaster had established this religion of Zoroastrianism, which is really quite interesting. Very few people know much about it, unfortunately, because this is where pretty much all the stuff that we are dealing with today has come from. Zoroaster saw that, he was the first one to see, or to write about it, to establish it, the idea that time is linear. That there was this creation time, this starting point, and it's traveling on and it's unfolding historically, and there'll be this end time. And all the while, there are these two gods. There's the Ahura Mazda, who is the epitome of goodness and wisdom. And there's this other one, at the moment his name escapes me, he goes by several names actually. Anyway, who's very evil, the embodiment of evil. Later on, the Israelites would think of this as the devil. But it's different in the Zoroastrian. These are like two gods, and they were duking it out. But eventually, in the end, and then people had this choice. You had this moral choice. Either you side with Ahura Mazda and all the good ones, or you side with the forces of evil. And some did. And actually, some of those that did, they worshipped these devas or these devis. And a lot of them moved off into India, where their gods were these little devis or devis. And by the way, as it filtered off into Babylon and Persia and other places like that, these became known as devils. You know, so the devis and the devils. And Ahura Mazda, that was like on the side of good there in Persia in that area, those Ahuras were called Asuras. And you know, in our teachings, in the Buddhist teachings, we talk about the Asuras, the jealous gods. These are the ones seen as in a negative way. We now look at that quite differently, at least when I talk about such things, it's radically different from any of this. So you have good and evil. Here in Babylon, then, where Zoroastrian religion flourished, and that was what was going on in Babylon at the time when the Israelites were there. They had this idea of this good and evil, these two good and evil entities duking it out, and it'll be this end time. There was also this character called the Sauciant, or the Son of Man, often referred to as the Son of Man, the Son of Man, the Son of Man. The Son of Man was always on their lips there in Babylon at that time. You know your Bible? Who's called the Son of Man in the Bible? Jesus, that's how he referred to himself. Son of Man. That term arose out of Zoroastrianism, and it was used in Babylon. And the Israelites, when they were there, they picked up that idea. And this idea of a Sauciant, a savior who would come at the end of days and save them and defeat, you know, along with Ahura Mazda's forces and defeat the evil ones, and then there would be this millennial reign after that, and where God finally straightened everything up, and then after that everything would be perfect. Zoroastrianism in a nutshell. A lot more to it, though, actually. And a lot that intertwines with what happens when the Israelites picked up these notions. But this is when these notions came about. And so now you had all this apocalyptic writing, because what was happening was, first of all, we had this covenant with God. That didn't seem to work out so well. What was the problem? Well, the prophets said, well, it's because you haven't been obeying the laws. Okay, but we've been obeying the laws. It still isn't working out so well. So now what is it? Well, it's because there's all this evil in the world. There's this evil force in the world. And, of course, the Israelites, they already had their God, but they never really thought about the God as being necessarily good or anything. These kind of connotations weren't strictly associated with it. In fact, God was kind of nasty often and had a temper and was jealous and all sorts of, you know, things. And why would he be jealous? Because there's a lot of other gods around, you see. That's how it all kind of started. But this time, though, this was their God, and okay, and there's something opposing it, but he was the one God, so this other thing couldn't be a God. Well, this ends up being the devil or a fallen angel and all the rest. But they eventually put all this together. So now they got these two forces here in the world, and that explains why and the kind of activity. But you don't actually find this in the Bible. This all came out of the apocalyptic writings. Before that, they didn't have these kinds of ideas. So these are Zoroastrian influences that are in there. Okay, now finally we get up to the time of Jesus and the people. They were looking for this Savior, this Messiah, this person who would come and save them, because they had picked up this kind of notion. And even though they follow the laws of God and that sort of thing, it's not for this world, it's for the next world. And so by being good and all this sort of thing, they will be saved. And that's how this notion got into the mix. And then we have this person, Jesus, coming along, who then takes on this identity as the Sauciant, as the Son of Man. Jesus was a millennialist. So were his followers. There's places in the Bible where Jesus said, it's right there in the scripture, I looked it up myself, where he says, I tell you that truly some of you here listening to me speaking today before tasting death will see the end of days. Before you die, some of you, not all of you, perhaps we die at different rates, different times, who knows, but some of you among us here now, before you taste death, will experience. Because that was one of the characteristics of it. It's imminent. It's due any time now. It's just around the corner. That's the kind of idea that they had. And so this is, too, why when Christ was on the... If you read the earliest accountings of the words that Christ spoke while on the cross, originally we only had two. I believe it was I thirst, and the other one was, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was a millennialist. He thought that this was going to be it, but all of a sudden his whole program here was thwarted. He was being put to death. How could he be the Sauschend? It's a big blow for them for a long time, several decades there. But then, of course, as time rolls on, in the writings you begin to see accountings, ways of accounting for how this could be. And finally, well, he had to die for the sins of the world. And these kinds of ideas started coming. Christ never spoke with those ideas at all. So this is how the stories are unfolding. And it goes on, and there's much more to it, and a lot of different angles to all of this. And the mixings of this with early Buddhist kinds of teachings. And the Zoroastrians, and the Greeks, all of this. It's really an amazing story, the whole thing. But most of us don't know the story. We don't know the whole story. I don't know if we'll ever get the whole story, but there's a lot more that could be learned about all of this. Finally, then, in about the year 95 or so, that's when the Apocalypse of John, the one that became the Book of Revelation that's in the Bible, that's when this one came along. They still had these apocalyptic writings among the Jews. First, it was among the Jews alone, the Israelites, and then, of course, the early Christians were bands of Israelites, Jews of various sects that were operating at that time. Some were millennialists, writing these apocalyptic kind of things, and there are many of these kinds of books, but only one survived, as we know it today. But to know its history like this might shed a little different light on it. And to take it literally as something that's going to happen, it's something about the end of time in our future, that sort of thing, that is not what these people understood, because they expected it was going to happen in their time. And if you read the Apocalypse of John, the Book of Revelations, in view of the fact that this was written to people who thought that this was just around the corner, what were they talking about? Well, biblical scholars have studied this and looked at this, and they'll decipher all of it. I can't take time now, I guess, but the way the apocalyptic writings are, this stuff had to be translated. It was written in symbolic ways, and then you'd needed an angel or something like that to translate it for you. And that's how it was with this John. He was struck with this revelation. And he was actually sucked up through a window, and it was just kind of a hard surface there, a blue hard surface, that he could be sucked through this window, and he got sucked through the window up into heaven, which was up above there. And that's where this revelation all took place. But he needed an angel then to explain it all to him. And there's a lot of interesting things that go on in this book of Revelations that sound horrific and awful in the end of days and all of this. But if you read it with an educated eye and mind and thought, and you understand what all the references are, it's clearly written for people that lived at that time, not for people in our time who might encourage a president who has nuclear weapons at his disposal. It's not about that at all. There's this story about the Whore of Babylon in this revelation. Well, what is this? She comes riding in on this monster that has seven heads. And, you know, this with the seven seals and the seven trumpets, there's all these kinds of seven. Well, it turns out that if you read it and you read it carefully, you realize that this Whore of Babylon is actually a city. And the seven heads on this monster are actually seven hills. So it's a city sitting on seven hills. What is that? It's Rome. And then this Antichrist, marked by these numbers 666. You know about 666? I used to work with a fellow many years ago who, when Minnesota first started putting the numbers, they had three letters and three numbers. You know, before it was, I don't know, two letters and four numbers or something. But all of a sudden they switched, and all of a sudden they had three. And this guy, poor fellow, I don't think they do this to anybody anymore. I think they've learned their lesson. But his license plate said 666 on it. And he was getting harassed as if he were the... Because this is the mark of the beast, the mark of the Antichrist. There are people who think that, well, you know... I've known some people who had 666 in their phone number and they had to change it. It's just mad. This is insanity. This is pure insanity. Well, what is 666 referred to? Well, it turns out if you spell out Caesar Nero in Hebrew letters, and these Hebrew letters all have a number associated with them, and then you add up the numbers, it adds up to 666. There's another place, however, where this Antichrist is referred to by the number 616, and as it turns out, Nero the name has two ways of spelling it. And if you spell it the other way, you end up with 616. Modern biblical scholars identify this as Nero, ancient emperor of Rome, who persecuted the early Christians. And so they identified Caesar Nero as the Antichrist. But when people don't understand this and they think this is still talking about the future and our future, and people all throughout have thought that this is referring to the end time. And the end times, of course, were always right around the corner. Centuries go by and it's still around the corner. And here we are and it's still around the corner. I mean, when I was a boy, there's always this talk about Russia, right? Well, the communists don't quite seem to be the problem anymore. So now we got Iran. You just, and then you can read into it what you want to read into it. But the Islamic traditions, they also have apocryphal kinds of ideas and writings because they followed all of this stuff too, and they have strong Zoroastrian influences that they might deny or not want to look at, just as Christians and Jews either are ignorant of or they don't want to look at it or consider it. But they also have similar ideas, and they also have this notion of the Mahdi who would come and save them. The Baha'is believe that this Mahdi was Baha'u'llah. But most of the Muslims reject that, and they're still looking for this guy. And here we have Ahmadinejad, who is caught up in this kind of thinking. And again, just going to duke it out on the map. Of course, he's seeing it all from the other side, you see. And this is what we've got in the world. Do you understand what I'm saying? These are leaders of countries, and with numbers of people encouraging them, pushing them along these ways. And they're completely caught up in total insanity. It is complete insanity and ignorance of history and of religious history, and with a misshapen, misguided notion about good and evil. That good and evil is like two different things out on a battlefield ready to duke it out until one is crushed. And of course, good, and we're always the good guys, no matter what. So this is an insane view of reality, of how it is. It isn't like this. Because if you strike them, they're going to strike back. It isn't like you strike them and then we trounce them and they're gone forever. It doesn't work that way. When they are gone forever, we too will be gone forever. And that's what we're doing. We are pushing our whole species to the brink of extinction with this. In my mind, this along with global warming are two things that we need to educate ourselves about and to wake up. That's why I'm talking to you now about this. Because if you ever run into somebody, I want you to understand how this kind of thinking came about, how we got here, and how misguided and foolish it is. Well, about the time the Apocalypse of John was being written, we had Nagarjuna over there in India. And I'm certainly not going to set Nagarjuna against this and look how right he was, because it doesn't work that way. Nagarjuna doesn't sell anything. He's not pushing a point of any kind. But it's a different way of looking at this whole problem where we never really get hold of anything here. But we remain sane. We don't get caught up in lunatic ideas and go charging off. And finally, as technology advances to the point where we have nuclear weapons in the world, and we're still carrying on with these archaic, foolish, dangerous, ignorant ideas, ignorant of history and all the rest of it. Taoism in China, appearing roughly around the same time as the Israelites were exiled in Babylon. Taoism also is a dualistic way of looking at things. But it is radically different. Because we see dualism. We see this and that. We see left and right, light and dark, good and bad, all that. We see that. But to think that that's somehow the mark of reality and that ultimately one side has got to trounce the other, that is where we go wrong. That is where that isn't reality. Reality isn't like that. It's like where we have, like in Taoism, the yin-yang symbol, those two lobes, one turning into the other and vice versa. You can't have one. If you draw one, you've drawn the other, in effect. You can't have one without the other. That's how they see the dualism, locked into a hole. And you can't have one without the other. And the idea that you're going to wipe that one out is your own destruction. It's a radically different view of how reality is and how it works. And most of us do not have this understanding of these different kinds of charging forces in life that our lives are actually made of, with this kind of holistic view. We tend to see it as the good guys pitted against the bad. It makes a good Hollywood movie. We can all identify with that. We identify with the good guys. And of course, yeah, there probably is things that aren't so good over there. But what is it that isn't good? It is things that are carrying on like they're going to destroy something else, as if something else could be put to death. You know, our precept of not to kill is the understanding, the deepest aspect of realizing that precept. And it's not a commandment. It is just simply an understanding of this is how it is. We're not commanded to not kill. But if you really understand killing, it means that you can't do away with the other. And to think that you can, and to act out of that thinking and that understanding, is to violate this precept of not to kill. So radically different. We're not commanded not to kill. We're not commanded anything, but we're invited to look carefully at how the nature of the world is set up and how it works and how it functions. I was kind of reminded of this last week. Juan challenged me to a game of Go. You know Go? Ancient Chinese board game. I used to play Go as a young man. I hadn't played in probably over 30 years when Juan... So he generously gave me a large handicap, probably more than I needed, but I do need a handicap if we do this again. Anyway, but what's interesting about Go, I remember this as a young man playing it back in my 20s. What was so curious about that game, I was used to games like maybe chess, checkers, or two, and they were pitted out. You know, this is how we kind of see it, one against the other until you trounce the other and wipe them out. Well, in the end, Go, too, is eventually one wins. But the dynamics of the game were just radically, and it was so odd to me, so strange, so foreign. I was just kind of mystified by it for a long time, just looking at how strange this game was. Because you're putting pieces down on a board, and eventually you're kind of staking out these different fields, and you're continuously interacting with the opponent. I suppose we could say the enemy, but let's just say the opponent. That allows you to play this game. And you, just as you allow them to play. And it's really kind of interesting, because what I noticed was, if I got aggressive, and I really started going after the opponent. You get them on the run, you know, and you think, man, I'm finally going to get you on the corner. I'm going to take all your pieces. Though you got them locked in the corner. And at some point, you're charging along like that. The next thing I know, all of a sudden, some of your pieces just get lifted off over here. Suddenly, you realize, hey, I'm in trouble now. Wait a minute, I needed those pieces to finish the job what I was doing here. And the next thing you know, you're now the victim. What's really interesting about this game, you become too aggressive with it, I've noticed. And it's a delicate balance. How much is too aggressive? It depends on the situation. You have to keep looking at it. It's a subtle, subtle game. But if you overdo that too much, it loops around and comes back and gets you. Just like, yes, we do this preemptive strike against Iran. Great. That's a great idea, isn't it? What do you suppose they're going to do? And if it isn't them, what about the rest of the Islamic world and the different factions there? There are some factions there that wouldn't take too kindly to that. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. What are the connections there? And what would they feel about the United States? I mean, it is such foolishness. It is a not understanding the nature of reality and how this is. It's a different way to play this game where we appreciate the opponent. We work with them in peculiar ways. And yes, there's ups and downs. But not so much with the attitude that I'm just going to go in there for the kill and wipe them out. This is to violate, as the teaching of the Awakened lays it out for us, this precept of not to kill. When I saw these millennialists on the TV, how ardent they were, how strident, how interested, how urgent they were to just go ahead, start this war between good and evil, bring on the end of days. And they have no idea where this idea of end of days came from, that it was Zoroaster. They have no idea of that. And they foolishly linked it to, in some ways, to phrases in Genesis. Well, these phrases in Genesis don't apply to that. If they knew the history, they wouldn't see it that way. And I don't mean to criticize them. That's one more thing. Another thing, Bill Moyers in his show. It's great the way he ended it. I think Bill maybe has a little bit of understanding with this. He was a preacher at one time, Methodist or something, I forget. But anyway, and there is real value in Christian teachings there, but they get hidden by all of this nonsense. But there are gems and jewels in there, which in the book I'm working on, eventually I want to bring those out. But there's so much danger and foolishness that goes on with this. Well, I was going to say Bill Moyers then. He ends with this accounting, this story. Remember about a year ago? I guess that's what it was. It was the anniversary of 5 girls in the Amish community in Pennsylvania were killed. And there were like 11 or 12 of them kind of lined up. And I don't know how many were shot, 10 or so maybe. 5, I guess, survived. And the whole world responded to that. And it had flowers and words of sympathy coming in from all over. To this little quiet community of these Amish people, who they just wanted to live, you know, simply and close. We all have our peculiarities and things that maybe we need to work on and stuff like that. But the one thing that they had here that was so beautiful and touching and moving, the thing that Bill Moyers brought out, was that a few days later when they were asked about the fellow who did this, by the way, 9 years earlier, he had a daughter, a young daughter, who died. And he was angry. He was angry with God for letting his daughter die. And it was festering with him for all this time until finally, in this act of desperation and madness, he takes these other little girls before killing himself. And then they asked the community, you know, how do you feel about this? Well, what the community did, they went out and they spoke to the family, the widow of the man who did this, and his family and his parents, with kindness and forgiveness. As the community, they forgave him. There were articles written up in papers about how people just blown away by that, astounded by that, but also thinking about this is foolish, kind of wasted forgiveness. How can you forgive something like that? But you see, when we see the world as a whole, we see it in terms of wholeness. This is where the healing takes place. And in the human world, the complexities of the human world, yes, sometimes things get warped and out of alignment, whatever. Out of anger, hatred, sadness. Guy loses his daughter. And how that all plays out and how he reacts to all of that in the community. And what do we do now? Get angry? Back and just keep it going? We're acting out of that idea that one, you know, we're the good and he was bad and we gotta kill him. He was so sad and so sick himself that he killed himself. What if he had? What do we do? Go in there and rip him up? What? Or do we just try to see all of this? Yes, there's sadness, there's pain, there's foolishness, there's anger. There's hatred, there's injustice. How are we ever going to let this settle down? And never mind about it out there in the world. First of all, how about just in your own mind? And can we learn by looking at the whole, by seeing this in totality, how to live in a way that is sane, that actually matches the way the world really unfolds? That nowhere does it unfold in such a way that you're going to have one side that's going to completely do away with the other. No matter how you feel, no matter how angry or hurt you are because of that injustice, because of that wrong done to you or whatever else, because of that threat you feel, it's So this is how we have to see this. And so too, like these millennialists, I'm not angry with them. That doesn't do any good. I want them to learn something more about, broaden their view a little bit. I don't think they're quite seeing it correctly here. More to be seen in this. And that maybe finally in the end to just let go of holding to some particular thing that you're going to try to bring through and push it through to the end. Wipe out the other. Because if you wipe out the other, you are gone yourself. So it doesn't do any good to hate back, to be angry back, or to cower in fear because these people are so crazy and they could really push us over the brink. Yes, it's a very dangerous situation. But our only way to deal with it is ourselves to become larger in our heart and mind and to embrace it, to realize it is there, to understand why it is there, how it came about, and to be watching our own heart and mind so that we ourselves don't get caught up, or just you yourself. I can't tell you what to do, but okay, for me, that's what I've got to do. That I don't allow myself to get carried away. And then when I do, and sometimes I do, I lose it, I get mad or something. And there's forgiveness there. No excuses. But, you know, I really want to walk this way. And I slip sometimes. Okay, now just get up again. And I want to walk this way. I want to know it. I want to retain it. I want to bring myself back to it as quickly as possible. I want to remain sane and open to all of this. And I want to understand other people when they're confused and full of hate and anger so that I don't get angry back. This is to see these two, because tunas of all kinds is surging back and forth, always. That's our life. But we need to see it in this larger way. And for that is, for each one of us, we just come back to looking at your own mind, your own heart, and to realize what the consequences are, what the stakes are here. They are total. Even just within your own life, your own individual life, they are total. Certainly they are in human society, and all we need to do is look. Well, anyway, after what I saw Friday night, I felt I had to say something. Sure.
I thought that the end of it, the last words that they said was, the lawyer pointed out that those people on the year anniversary of the killing again reiterated that forgiveness was hard, but it came without a community, and that the lack of forgiveness destroys community. So the brilliant thing about that is that they were not seeing themselves as selves.
Exactly.
But as connected.
And that's what we need. That's what we need to do.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. That last quote that they gave there. It takes community. We can find this. That's what Sangha is all about. But we have to understand this. That as Sangha, people coming together to follow this way. That's where you can find the support to do this. Because as an individual, yes, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to do. But of course, that's where your responsibility lies. You can't rely on the other to be doing this work. You have to do it. But yes, as it is expressed in the community, and that's where, if enough of us start to understand this, and we can start to live this way, that in itself will become a healing force that can reach out and help in so many other ways. But we have to understand this, that this isn't about walling ourselves off in a particular identity and that we're the good ones now and boy, we got it, you better learn from us now how to do this. No, it is all, I just forget that. And then we just take this way up and practice it. And human communities do form. If only we could have a one of enlightenment here. Nothing would please me more. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.